This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
When our water heater broke down last month, it was a nightmare. It took 5 hours for the plumber to show up, and he charged us a couple of $100 just to come out. Then it cost another $1,800 to put in the new water heater. By the time it was all said and done, I felt like I'd been taken. But what else could I do?
The smartest thing you can do is get a home warranty from American Residential Warranty. Their home warranties pay to repair or replace all your major appliances when they break. And they will break, and at the worst possible time. Call American Residential Warranty right now for free information on home warranties starting at just pennies a day. Don't wait for your refrigerator to stop running or your ceiling fans to stop turning. Call American Residential Warranty right now. Ask how you can save up to 50% on washer and dryer coverage. Just call 1-800-686-3910. That's 1-800-686-3910. Again, 1-800-686-3910. Call now.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you very much for joining. Great to have you with me. The first in the nation primary is today in New Hampshire.
And it is set up to be quite a contest. There's a lot of nastiness going on around there. Things have heated up between the various campaigns. We know that Jeb has called Trump a loser, that Trump is saying that Jeb needs his mommy to help him on the campaign trail. Christie has called Rubio the bubble boy. I'm not sure how Rubio has responded, but I could take some guesses as to how I would if I were in his shoes or his very fancy boots, for example. But it's getting a bit personal. It's getting a bit nasty. And it's because on the Republican side, after Trump, the race seems wide open. Latest polling, according to Real Clear Politics, has Trump at 33 going into today. Rubio at 14. Despite his issues, he's in third place here. Kasich at 17% in this poll. Kasich in the number two spot, New Hampshire. What are you trying to do to me here? You also have Cruz at 10, Bush at 9, Christie at 8, then Fiorina at 3, and Carson at 1. Carson campaign seems to be completely sputtering out. But Trump has this enormous lead. Now, will this in fact be the way it goes down? Very tough to tell. These polls are particularly sketchy. You have in New Hampshire, independents, or people who are unaffiliated with party, can go and same day register and vote in either primary. And a big chunk of the state's voters are in this unaffiliated category. So this means that it's very tough to see, very tough to know who's sort of likely to vote among these unaffiliated voters. It's also tough to know whether the polls are giving you an accurate reading of all of this. So right now there's voting that's already happening, but there have been efforts underway over the last couple of days and in the last couple of weeks, really, to just pound these voters with all sorts of messaging efforts. The New Hampshire airwaves have been absolutely saturated with this stuff. It's been all over the place. There was an estimate I saw that $100 million worth of commercials have been deployed for voters. And it's just astonishing. And there's actually one that's a documentary, they say, about Bush that is 14 minutes and 16 seconds. So it's just tons of money being piled into this. And there are even pieces being written about how some of the residents of various New Hampshire towns are trying to hide. They don't want to open their mail. They don't want to answer the door. They don't want to pick up the phone because there's all this effort underway to try to do whatever's possible to make things happen and get that last and final push going into all of this. So is Trump, in fact, going to have this huge victory? Well, that sort of remains to be seen at this point. It remains to be seen. But we know that there are all sorts of also. Oh, we've got a Trump. Oh, wow. You have Trump calling an audience member, or rather, Trump repeats back an audience member who called. We're not going to play that clip. Called Ted Cruz a bad word. It's bleeped. Oh, are we sure it's bleeped? Okay. All right. Donald Trump repeated something very mean about Ted Cruz. We can play that clip. Play clip three.
You heard the other night at debate, they asked Ted Cruz, serious question, well, what do you think of waterboarding? Is it okay? And honestly, I thought he'd say absolutely, and he didn't. He said, well, it's, you know, he's concerned about the answer because some people, she just said a terrible thing. You know what she said? Shout it out because I don't want to. Okay, you're not allowed to say, and I never expect to hear that from you again. She said, I never expect to hear that from you again. She said he's a That's terrible. Terrible.
This is what this has turned into now. This is like schoolyard taunts and insults, and Trump is reveling in it. I mean, he's not going to back down from any of this stuff at all. And you got Chris Christie saying, well, look, he wouldn't go to the level that Trump has gone to here. He wouldn't personally use this kind of language. Play clip four.
I wouldn't do it, but he did. You know, it's kind of amazing to be in a race where someone will say things more direct than I do. But, you know, I don't think it's the kind of thing that a presidential candidate says. But that's Donald. And you know, I know him for a long time, so he's going to do what he's going to do.
He is. In fact, he's going to even go on Morning Joe and play a word association game where he just sort of lets it fly with whatever he thinks about various candidates. First thing that comes to his mind, clip eight.
Jeb Bush.
Loser.
Okay.
What a coincidence.
It's so funny. You should say that. Marco Rubio.
Confused.
Ted Cruz.
I was going to say nasty. He's not really nasty. I mean, he's been very nice. Here he goes on and off. I'll say nasty.
Nasty. Okay.
Stick with it.
Hillary Clinton.
She went to your wedding, right?
Wow.
She did. She did. She did. In a certain way, evil. In a certain way, evil.
Whoa. Bill Clinton.
Intelligent.
Oh, well, he's had something nice to say about Bill Clinton, who, by the way, has been pretty ineffective from what we've been able to see so far on the campaign trail for Hillary. People are saying he looks tired. People are saying he looks beaten down. He looks old. He looks like he doesn't really have it in him anymore to do this. That's at least even from some Democrats who are Clinton supporters. They're saying it's just not the same thing anymore. So anyway, this is what matters now for the Republicans. Who's going to come in second, third, and fourth, really, because they'll have some narrative to continue their campaigns into South Carolina. And they've thought that Rubio was going to get a pretty nasty hit. He'd have a drop in the polls after that debate performance where he went Robo Rubio and repeated himself four times. That doesn't seem to necessarily be the case, although Kasich at 17% is kind of a shock. I don't know what to say about that one, New Hampshire. If you let John Kasich take the number two spot, we are going to have a problem here. We're going to have some stuff to talk about. But for a number of the campaigns, this is probably going to be it for them if they don't have a strong enough showing. I think you can assume that Chris Christie is not going to stay in it for much longer. Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, unless somehow, some way, they have results today in New Hampshire that would give them the necessary boost for their campaigns, doesn't look like they're going to stay in this much longer. So if you believe the polls, it's going to be Trump by a large margin. And then who's going to come in the number two spot? It doesn't look like Ted Cruz is likely to win again as he did in Iowa, but obviously expects a much stronger showing will be possible in South Carolina. You've got Rubio, you've got Kasich, you've got all these different candidates that are kind of vying for maybe the two spot, maybe the three spot. And the establishment slot, such as it is, seems to be open right now. Oh, and Jeb, by the way, who's poor. There's so much money with the Jeb campaign. It's amazing he hasn't really gotten more traction. Jeb's always sort of just trailing in the middle of the pack somewhere of all these candidates. He says that this is not, that New Hampshire is not a do or die situation for him. Play clip five.
Governor, what about this notion that it's do or die here in New Hampshire?
No. It's not do or die. We have a real organization in South Carolina, the best organization in Nevada, a nationwide campaign. I know there's the punditry class loves to kind of settle it all, but voters will get to do this, and it's starting today. I'm excited about it.
No, he's saying that he's in it to win it. And there are a few small towns, by the way, where voting started at midnight to kick off the primary. Towns of Dixville, Notch, Millsfield, and Hart's location. So those are Dixville, Notch, Millsfield, and Hart's location. Those are places where the voting has already happened. Trump, Cruz, and Kasich won those towns. So that's very, very early, right? There's a very small number of votes that have actually been tallied at this point. But on the other side of it, Bernie Sanders has gotten off to a strong lead with a vote count of 17-9 based on just these few towns voting. Now, Bernie's numbers, by the way, going into this, according to the same or the most recent polling we have on Real Clear Politics, Bernie is at 53. Clinton is at 44. So he's got a strong lead. He is up 9 points on Hillary Clinton. And there are some who are saying that this is not going to be enough, obviously, to change the overall narrative that Hillary is probably going to win. Although, if you look at some of the national polls now, Hillary and Bernie are within the margin of error of each other. Things have tightened up dramatically. Things have gotten a lot closer for these two. So there really is the possibility that the Sanders campaign, if they have a very strong showing here in New Hampshire, the Sanders campaign may come out of all this and say, you know what? You know what we really need to do here? We just need to explain. We need to get the word out there. We need to promote that Sanders is doing just as well against Republican candidates in head-to-head matchups nationally as Hillary is. I mean, if I'm Hillary Clinton at this point, I've got to think that I'm freaking out somewhat at the possibility that once again a sort of much lesser-known challenger from the left is going to come in and mess up the presidency that she so clearly thinks is essentially hers by right at this point, Queen Hillary. She seems to believe that this is something that only that she must do this, that she has to do this, and the American people need her. So Hillary, she was asked about her prospects in New Hampshire, and here's what she said, clip 7.
I'm just here to thank all of the people who have worked so hard for me. I've got a lot of longtime friends who have been working day and night for me, and all of these people who are out here so early in the morning. This is a great process, and as I've said over the last couple of days, we're going to keep working literally until the last vote is cast and counted.
What's your prediction for tonight?
Go from there. I just love the way New Hampshire does this.
Oh, I just love New Hampshire. That's her prediction for tonight. I just love New Hampshire. Oh, well, I suppose that answers that then. What else is there really to say or be said about this? She says she loves New Hampshire. I guess we just have to take her at her word that there's no point in continuing on beyond that. She's given us the least substantive answer possible to that question. She does think the GOP is focusing on her, however, a ton because they are afraid of her. That's what she says. She says that they're scared of her. And from an electoral perspective, that's why there's so much focus on her. Clip 2.
But I want your viewers and anyone else who would be interested in this to ask themselves, why does the right, and particularly the Republicans, spend so much time, money, and effort through the media, through their advertising? Because you look at the Republicans are running more ads against me than they run against each other, accusing me of being this and that, all kinds of accusations. Why? And I'll tell you why. Because they are afraid of me. They know that I will be a president who, yes, I will listen to people, I will seek common ground, but I will stand my ground, and I know how to get things done.
I'm afraid of having to listen to her give speeches where she screeches and yells for the next 8 years, but that's all that I think I'd have to say I'm afraid of when it comes to Hillary Clinton. It's going to be a tough day in the Clinton camp today. It'll probably just be this day. It's not going to last much longer than that for them. I think they are planning on winning South Carolina pretty handily, and then things will fall into place more or less. But you can expect that all the Clintonistas are going to feel the burn. Bernie Sanders is going to have a banner day, a great day for the Sanders campaign in New Hampshire. So he's going to have something to celebrate. Tim, have you ever thought about a silencer for your firearm? Let me tell you, a silencer is an important accessory that gives you added hearing protection and just makes the whole shooting experience more fun. If you're looking for a silencer, all you have to do is go to silencershop.com. You follow the step-by-step instructions, you watch videos and reviews, and then you make the perfect selection from the most popular brands, and you can purchase your silencer right there on silencershop.com. They'll handle the details, and your nearest Powered by Silencer Shop dealer will call you when your silencer is ready. Silencers allow you to wear literally no hearing protection. They just make the whole thing easier, more enjoyable for you. You get better social interaction when you're out at the range, if you're out hunting, whatever it is, however it is you're using your firearm. Silencershop.com also offers easy financing. In fact, they'll return your finance charge as a gift certificate after your final payment. So help make the world a quieter place. Visit silencershop.com to find a silencer for your firearm. Back after this break.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, you have two very different candidates running right now on the Democrat side of things, at least when it comes to style. I think in substance, they're not really that different, but when it comes to how they present and how they spend their time and the sorts of people that show up at their events, there are some interesting differences. This is what the Washington Examiner wrote about in the last 24 hours about a Bernie Sanders campaign rally. Said, by now the campaign rally looked hardly like a political event. The singer danced with Bernie voters, and then after a couple upbeat songs, asked the young voters to sit on the ground with him. The entire arena sat on the ground, put their arms around each other, and sang, "Lean on Me," underneath the Bernie 2016 banner. By the time Sanders finally took the stage, 2 hours late due to the snowstorm raging outside, the crowd was in full kumbaya mode, having spent hours dancing to live bands and talking about the ideals of democratic socialism. After the candidate gave his usual stump speech, all the bands took to the stage together to sing a custom song entitled Feel the Burn. So Bernie Sanders, if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, it's sort of like going to a fish show or it's like going to see back in the day, I guess, the Grateful Dead or something. That's the vibe you get from a Bernie Sanders political rally. It's a little bit different with Hillary Clinton. She's a different type. She's not quite as warm and cuddly as Bernie Sanders is. And she's also got a bit of a problem on her hands. And that is that people are pointing out that her rhetoric about Wall Street and how she wants to hold them accountable and she wants to take all these bankers and show them that the middle class is what really matters and that they're not going to get away with this anymore. And all the class warfare stuff, all the rhetoric that she's pushing out there. Hillary saying all of this. Meanwhile, we know that she gave some very highly paid speeches to, for example, Goldman Sachs. We know she did that. And people have started to wonder, well, what does she sound like? Does she show up at these very powerful, very wealthy investment banks? Does she show up at these financial institutions and give them the same sort of class warfare nonsense that she does on the campaign trail? That would seem to be a strange thing for Goldman Sachs to pay to hear. You know, hey, here's $250,000 for an hour of your time. Tell us how terrible we are. Tell us how we are destroying the American economy. But, oh, wait a second. That's not what she does, is it? No, she has a very different tone when she's giving a speech to Goldman Sachs, for example. She's a very different one indeed. She spoke to, for example, this is from Politico.com. One person at attendance at one of her Goldman Sachs speeches said it was pretty glowing about us. This is all from Politico. It's so far from what she sounds like as a candidate now. It was like a rah-rah speech. She sounded more like a Goldman Sachs managing director. At another speech to Goldman and its big asset manager clients in New York, Clinton spoke about how it wasn't just the banks that caused the financial crisis, and it was worth looking at the Dodd-Frank financial reform law to see what was working and what wasn't. So she tells people at the investment banks that she knows that Dodd-Frank is unworkable. She knows that Dodd-Frank is a bad idea. She knows that Dodd-Frank is problematic. That's what she tells people at the banks when they're paying her a lot of money. And now when she's running for president, she's saying, oh, well, the banks are the problem. These rich fat cats on Wall Street are the problem. And we're going to rein in Wall Street because Wall Street's what's causing all of the economic issues in this country. There's nothing else out there, right? It's not government regulation. It's not globalization. It's not the government picking winners and losers and redistributing wealth among those already here, redistributing wealth to those who are newly arrived in the form of legal and illegal immigrants. That's not the problem, you see. It's just all Wall Street. Unless you're paying Hillary a lot of money, then it's not a problem. Then the bigger the check, the better. And she's going to tell you, Goldman Sachs and others, how wonderful you are. More coming up.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
When our water heater broke down last month, it was a nightmare. It took 5 hours for the plumber to show up, and he charged us a couple of $100 just to come out. Then it cost another $1,800 to put in the new water heater. By the time it was all said and done, I felt like I'd been taken. But what else could I do?
The smartest thing you can do is get a home warranty from American Residential Warranty. Their home warranties pay to repair or replace all your major appliances when they break. And they will break, and at the worst possible time. Call American Residential Warranty right now for free information on home warranties starting at just pennies a day. Don't wait for your refrigerator to stop running or your ceiling fans to stop turning. Call American Residential Warranty right now. Ask how you can save up to 50% on washer and dryer coverage. Just call 1-800-686-3910. That's 1-800-686-3910. Again, 1-800-686-3910. Call now.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Well, the First in the Nation primary in New Hampshire is underway, and we here in the Freedom Hut are now joined by political editor for The Blaze, Lee Munsell. Lee, thank you for calling in. You're up in New Hampshire. What's going on up there?
Hey, thanks for having me. It's snowy up here. That's kind of the first thing I noticed, but voting is underway. It started last night at midnight in Dixville Notch and a couple other smaller precincts up north, because apparently I learned this the other day, but the law in New Hampshire is that it has to be open, your polling place has to be open between like 10 a.m. and I believe 6 p.m., but you can open it at any point and close it at any point, or 7 p.m., and then a couple places stay open till 8. But in general, that's why they do the midnight voting, is because technically they can be open at midnight if they want to be.
All right. And so far what we've seen is that there's, from what I can read already, it looks like there's a pretty strong Bernie surge. And on the Republican side, no big surprises yet. Kasich, Trump, and Cruz are getting pretty good early votes, early voting results. Is that what you're hearing? Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, that's what the results were last night. But keep in mind, you know, we're talking about 30 or 40 votes, so not exactly an exact sample of the electorate.
The state,
so we'll see what actually happens. But those early results usually, you know, give some indication of what New Hampshireites are thinking, but they don't, you know, they're pretty statistically insignificant.
Now, what are the campaigns doing in terms of setting expectations? Let's start on the Republican side of things. Who is this considered do or die for by those you're talking to, and how are the campaigns, other than Trump, who seems, if you believe the polls, seems like a kind of a shoo-in here, how are they trying to position themselves?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of campaigns that have really, you know, put a lot of their hopes in New Hampshire. Chris Christie is one of those, as well as Jeb Bush and John Kasich have all really focused on trying to win New Hampshire votes. So the three of them are really going to hope for some good results today. It'd be interesting to see where Jeb ends up, because he's focused so much on New Hampshire. And it seems like he's been surging in recent days. He's had a lot of excitement at his events, and a lot of people have been showing up on the ground. So there is kind of some buzz that maybe he'll do better than expected in New Hampshire, which would be a big boost for his campaign. But some other things we're seeing, like Ted Cruz, for example, had really, really high expectations in Iowa, but his campaign is trying to kind of downplay his expectations here, which shows that, you know, they don't want the same kind of hype and expectation situation here that there was in Iowa, because he won't finish as high likely as he did there. And Marco Rubio now, there's been a lot of hope that he'll do well in New Hampshire. And so the expectations are fairly high for him. And if he doesn't do as well as expected, that could end up hurting him in the long run.
I'm reading articles about how New Hampshire is completely flooded from a media perspective, from a from also just the sort of direct mail and ground game. All this stuff has been going on until the very end of all of this. Which campaign on the GOP side is considered to have the best ground game? And do you think that could is that a factor that maybe the polls aren't necessarily haven't been taking into account?
You know, I'm not sure who has the best ground game on the Republican side. I know that Kasich certainly himself has been doing a ton of FaceTime with voters. He was the first one to reach 100 town hall meetings in New Hampshire, and the others are getting closer to that now a couple days later. But he certainly kind of set the trend for actually being in New Hampshire. But as far as, you know, people walking around, getting out the vote, being at precincts and all of that, there's a pretty like strong Jeb Bush network here. And a lot of, you know, Jeb Bush supporters and staffers and stuff here. So, again, he's one that you could maybe see do better tonight than you would expect. Although, if he doesn't, then that's going to end up really being trouble for his campaign.
Yeah, I mean, the Jeb, we played some audio of Bush before saying that this isn't do or of Jeb, of course, Jeb exclamation point, saying that this isn't do or die for his campaign. But I think the expectations from the rest of us who aren't just trying to come up with some sort of spin is that if Jeb doesn't do very well, if he isn't really at least a top four, if not a top three finisher in New Hampshire, it looks like he's just hanging on for no good reason at this point. On the Hillary side of things, doesn't seem like anybody believes she's going to win New Hampshire. Is she just trying to prevent a rout? Is that the best that her campaign can really offer to those who are asking what expectations should be coming out of New Hampshire?
Yeah, well, most people are not expecting a lot from Hillary today as far as her numbers go, which is actually where she wants to be. She doesn't want the expectation to be that she should do very well here. But yeah, the more she loses by, the worse it'll look for her campaign. So she's going to want to keep it as close as possible. They did a lot of stuff in the past couple of days, a lot of get out the vote rallies, big venues, a lot of people at them. So that's been kind of their focus, is to actually, you know, do a little better than they've been polling in New Hampshire.
Have you been able to go cover in person any of the Bernie Sanders rallies? And are you always immediately ensconced in clouds of some sort of vaporous, pungent, odorous stuff? Or what are the Bernie Sanders rallies like?
Yeah, I was just at a Bernie Sanders rally yesterday. And Bernie Sanders rallies are actually pretty fun comparatively to the other ones. There's a lot of excitement, a lot of young
people. I'm sure.
It's just kind of a different atmosphere than the others. They have, you know, fun warm-up music at the beginning. They were playing Disco Inferno yesterday, the Burn Baby Burn song. And there's just kind of like a lot of excitement at those rallies. So they tend to be more fun to go to. I wrote a story yesterday. He was talking about how students need, you know, bailouts from student loan debt. And he mentioned he had one of the people in the audience stand up and tell how much student loan debt she had, and she said she had, you know, $200,000 in debt for a grad degree from Columbia University. And then he went on to talk about how, you know, that money essentially needs to be repaid by taxing Wall Street, which is interesting. So anyway, that story's up on the Blaze. They basically said there needs to be a bailout for student debt money, which is a really kind of interesting little exchange on the campaign trail yesterday.
Now, Bernie Sanders rallies are the most fun and have the best music from what I'm hearing up there. But if you're looking for pure spectacle, are the Trump rallies the ones that you really have to stop by and see?
Yeah, the Donald Trump ones are certainly always interesting. Last night he was at the Verizon Wireless Arena, and the snow was coming down. People were told, you know, that it was a pretty intense winter storm and to be careful not to travel. And yet he still, you know, packed out the place with a big crowd, and ended up making some news for calling Ted Cruz a pejorative term, or at least repeating it. And so, you know, that sort of thing. It's a wild card when you go to Donald Trump events, what you're going to get. whether he'll say something or do something that's just entirely unexpected, which is pretty different from the very, you know, carefully honed and crafted images of a lot of the other candidates.
Or is it your expectation from what you're hearing from those covering the campaigns alongside you that after New Hampshire, will there be a couple of drops from the Republican side of things?
You know, it'll be interesting to see. A lot of Christie was saying the other day that he has a plane ticket to South Carolina on Wednesday, and he intends to make it. A lot of them are saying that. A lot of them have said that before. But I guess Ben Carson is flying out to South Carolina tonight. He's not even going to go to his watch party or victory party. He's going to head straight to South Carolina. I don't know. I mean, it's possible. Jeb Bush, Chris Christie are possible dropouts if they don't do as well here as they thought. John Kasich, although it looks like he's going to finish fairly strong, so that could give him more momentum. Another key dynamic of this race, too, is to see how Donald Trump does, because, you know, a fairly disappointing finish in Iowa and a lot of expectation that he'll win here, but he hasn't yet proven that he can live up to the polls. So we'll see if he actually does tonight.
So you think that there's an argument you made that Trump, it's not enough for Trump to just win in New Hampshire. He has to win pretty big, or else people are going to start to question whether he can just point to polls all the time and say, see, I'm crushing everybody.
Yeah, well, and he's a very non-traditional candidate. So in a lot of ways, his Iowa finish wasn't terrible. But again, he's been polling so well, and he hasn't yet proven, although he could prove it tonight, that it actually will translate to voters showing up to the polls. You know, he had a decent amount of support in Iowa, but not remotely like what he was polling at. And so that's a key question.
Has the Robo Rubio thing, by the way, has that caught on at all with New Hampshire voters? Anyone you've spoken to or what are you picking up on that? You know, he's repeating himself four times in the debate, because it seems like in the polls it hasn't really made a difference. But are you hearing sort of anecdotally that people are a little more questionable on Rubio, who might have been favorably disposed to towards him before?
Yeah, well, the campaign spin on that is that, you know, he actually got more interest and more search spikes and everything since the last debate. But there is concern, maybe less about the repeating himself. I think that's part of it, but more about, you know, how carefully he stays on message and how he doesn't seem as authentic as maybe some of the other candidates. And that sort of thing doesn't play well in New Hampshire. So I've heard some of that dynamic that people are concerned that he won't ever stray from his talking points. And in a primary season that's really loved tough talk from candidates like the Ted Cruz's and Donald Trump's of the world, if Marco Rubio doesn't take any swings in the near future, he might kind of turn off the voters who want someone more fiery than he's been.
All right. Lee Munsell, political editor at The Blaze. Thank you so much for calling in. Keep us updated. Great to have you on.
Will do. Thanks.
All right, team. Phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. More in just a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network. Show.
Hillary Clinton is certainly a flawed candidate. A few days ago after the Democrat debate, I was part of a panel of all Democrats, the only conservative over on this panel at CNN, and I was trying to explain why Hillary is such a flawed candidate. We talked a little bit about how she gives speeches to Goldman Sachs in which she tells Goldman Sachs how great they are. Then she tells the rest of America that Goldman Sachs is bad, the worst.
I hate Goldman Sachs.
But we shouldn't believe her because she'll do anything for money and power. She has no scruples. She has no integrity or reputation really to protect, at least when it comes to honesty. But this is a big problem for her because the class warfare narrative that really propelled Barack Obama to his second term, by the way, that's how he defeated Romney. It was just a lot of class warfare. That's very tough to hear, even for somebody of very limited intellectual means. Very tough to hear a person who has made over $100 million with her husband in a sort of tag team of speech giving and influence peddling and selling talk about, to hear these people talk about, and particularly Hillary,
how much she cares about you and understands the struggle and understands what it means to be trying to pay bills, and that she's above corruption. She's above reproach on these issues. It's just too much. This is what I said in this panel on CNN. Just wanted to share it with you in light of today's primary and how Hillary's, and what we're seeing is Hillary's probably going to get trounced in New Hampshire. There's a reason for that. And here's what I had to say about it. Play the clip.
But most people aren't the First Lady of the United States, as Angela said.
Oh, it's what the market
a former
pays.
Secretary of State,
it's
a former senator. Yeah. And
why
it's what the market pays is that.
Point?
So, okay,
she's,
but that's the point.
She's running for elected office again.
But don't you think most people should understand that?
Go ahead.
I mean, I think the assumption was, and all of America was assuming at the time, that people writing those checks were assuming that she was essentially going to be running for president and was a likely winner of the presidency. So that obviously ups the fees. Look, this is the Achilles heel of the Clinton campaign. This is what she can't get around. You mentioned before she doesn't have a better answer. There is no better answer, and it's because it's true. And Bernie Sanders doesn't have to hit it very hard. I would agree with Van as well. He could have hit it harder. He could have been a little tougher on her and come around at her from another angle. The fact of the matter is, it's not just a couple $100,000 here and there for speeches. It's between her and her husband, by the way, who was getting paid while she was Secretary of State outrageous fees for these kinds of speeches to the tune of over $100 million fortune. They didn't start any great company. They gave a whole lot of speeches to a lot of people. Bernie Sanders is making the point that the government is up for sale, and Hillary Clinton is the poster child. She's the best example you can give to a government.
And here's how she responds. No, here's how she responds. She responds
just jumping in all over the place. No, we're not going to hear your response. It's just jumping in all over the place there. Don't let Buck say it either. But that's the truth. It's the truth. People saying, oh, but you know, former president. Really? Did Bush make over $100 million giving speeches and plan on having Barbara, or not Barbara, that's his mom, Laura run for the presidency while he's doing that? What other presidential duo, first lady and former president, have, while one of them was planning on running for the presidency, so not out of politics, that's a key distinction, made over $100 million giving speeches? I mean, the speeches are really that worthwhile? What is Hillary Clinton telling Goldman Sachs that they don't already know? That's what I would like to know. What is Hillary Clinton telling any of these very wealthy benefactors of hers that's worth the amount of money she's being paid? People say that's what the market will bear. Yeah, because everybody saw what happened in 2008, right? Maybe a little refresher is in order here. Goldman Sachs got paid back 100 cents on the dollar for its obligations, for its enormous financial hole that it had gotten itself into. Right. And Goldman Sachs had connections to the very top of the administration, as we know. Lehman Brothers. Nope. That got to collapse. 2008. The lesson is, you know what the best insurance you can have against catastrophic failure for your financial institution is? Connections in the federal government at the very top. This is the same reason why I once heard somebody tell me that, you know, he always plans on he gives every time somebody runs for a district attorney. He gives the maximum amount of money to every candidate. Why? Considers it a form of insurance. Better to have given every district attorney that I may possibly face in a white-collar suit, better to have given all of them money than to have just given one because I'm trying to buy just a little bit of favoritism. Now, that was at a local level. This guy told me this. I don't even know if he was telling the truth or not. Maybe he was making a joke. The point is that people understand what influence is, and people understand that if you write big enough checks, you can curry favoritism. So just maybe some of these large financial institutions realize, hey, if we want to make sure the next time there's a huge crash, we get bailed out and our competitors don't, maybe we pay the people that will be making those decisions now. More coming up.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Let's get into a Buck Brief.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
Marine Corps Lieutenant General Vincent Stewart, the head of the
Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, has said that the Islamic State is likely to step up the pace and lethality of its attacks in the coming months as it moves to increase its reach outside its home base of Iraq and Syria. This courtesy of the Washington Times. He said last year, Daesh, which is another term used for the Islamic State, remained entrenched on Iraqi and Syrian battlefields and expanded globally to Libya, Sinai, Afghanistan, Nigeria, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the Caucasus. He said Daesh is likely to increase the pace and lethality of its transnational attacks because it seeks to unleash violent actions and to provoke a harsh reaction from the West. He also pointed to the group's expanding influence in Mali, Tunisia, Somalia, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. So these are all countries that are in play right now for the Islamic State. We tend to think of ISIS as this group that is based in Iraq and Syria, and there are a few far-flung affiliates here and there. But in fact, 2015 was a very good year for ISIS affiliates. They are getting more deeply entrenched in the countries in which they've already established some presence. And beyond that, they're looking to go into new countries, into other Muslim countries where they don't need to be in huge numbers. They just have to exist in large enough numbers to draw some recruits, to engage in attacks, and to create the perception that they are another caliphate in waiting. Right? It destabilizes the government, it destabilizes the country just to have an ISIS affiliate that can pull off attacks and that continues despite security precautions against it. When you start adding into the mix here the possibility of a real and established ISIS affiliate in, for example, Mali, in Bangladesh, in Indonesia, you see the scope and extent of this group and its reach goes far beyond Iraq and Syria. And so even if we were able to defeat it entirely, to eradicate the Islamic State on the battlegrounds of Iraq and Syria, it would still exist elsewhere, right? It is an ideology. It is an organization. It's not just fighters holding one piece of territory, one contiguous piece of territory in the Middle East. It has already spread. And in fact, when you look at the latest assessments of what we're facing in the Middle East from Islamic extremism, there's not a lot of cause for optimism right now. Some of this is, of course, lost on the media, as I know there's so much focus on the primary. There's such a focus being put on the various candidates and what they've said and what's going on in the ground game. And we do some of that here. I try to make sure that we also get into all the other news of the day and keep our eyes on the ball. James Clapper, who's the director of National Intelligence, the DNI, has also estimated that violent extremists are active in about 40 countries and that there are more terrorist safe havens now than at any time in modern history. So you have more countries that have at least some portion of them operating as a safe haven for terrorist operations. Now, of course, when any member of the Obama administration refers to violent extremism, when any member of the Obama administration does that, you can assume that we're really talking about Islamic jihadism, violent extremism. But they prefer to just refer to it as just a sort of generic extremism. And maybe there's a couple of other groups that they'll put in there. You know, they'll refer to the FARC as violent extremists or some other such Marxist organization that doesn't really have pretensions of blowing up airplanes full of people all over the world and trying to establish a contiguous religious fascist state around the globe. But yeah, I guess they're extremists. So this is one of the ways that the administration constantly plays these word games. The need that we have at this point to try to come up with a strategy should be very apparent to everybody who cares about these matters. And even if you think that the Middle East is something that we should largely just try to either ignore or stay out of, as I've said to you before, it's only a matter of time before something is pulled off by the Islamic State, before the Islamic State does something that forces our hand, and you will have U.S. troops in one of these countries. I don't know which one it's even going to be at this point. We already have U.S. troops in Iraq. We already have U.S. troops in numbers that the Pentagon won't tell us in Syria. But what about some of these other countries? What you think these governments are so stable? You think that there's such such excellent security and counterterrorism forces that you could not have Islamic State fighters overturning the established government, or at least posing a real threat to it, and creating a carve-out space, a safe haven for further ISIS operations. This is already what they've done in Libya. This is what they've done in the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. And they have freedom of movement in these places. They can recruit, they can train, they can plot further operations. They also have, of course, an affiliate with Boko Haram in Nigeria that engages in such wanton and widespread violence that when we look at methods of trying to combat them, you recognize that Nigeria is really in something of a civil war right now. It's just a continuous civil war that doesn't have clearly defined sides. It's a counterinsurgency, sure, but it's also become conventional forces deployed against forces that can often beat them in the field. So these are the levels that we're dealing with. This is the extent of the ISIS threat around the world. And so when you hear these various candidates talking about how they're going to defeat and destroy ISIS, this is a multi-generational fight we're looking at now. This is the new Cold War. This is not just we put a few thousand troops in Iraq and Syria and they'll mop this up and this will all be over with. People who say things like we're going to establish a Sunni Arab ground force to defeat the Islamic State, good luck with that. We've been trying to do that with the Iraqi government for the last 10 plus years. We've been trying to do that in different ways in neighboring countries, trying to train forces to put back into Syria. And so far, those efforts have been catastrophic failures. When we have candidates talking about how they're going to train a Sunni Arab-led army to defeat the Islamic State, they should keep in mind that the Obama administration, which doesn't take this problem as seriously as it should and has not been honest with the American people about the full scope and extent of the threat, the Obama administration managed to train 50 people at a cost of $500 million. And those 50 essentially melted away the moment they hit the battlefield. And that was after years of trying to put all of this together. So creating an army in the Middle East right now that can stand up to the Islamic State, which does have already tens of thousands of hardened and dedicated fighters who are engaged in combat right now. Remember, they're becoming more and more capable as a force the longer that they have to both train, equip, and to battle it out with either Assad's forces, Iraqi government forces, the Kurds. This is not something that's going in our favor. This is one of the big misconceptions the Obama administration has tried to push on all of us, and that is that the longer we wait, the better off we'll be, because we're being deliberative. You see, we're working with our allies. We're thinking this through. We don't shoot from the hip. We have a conference. We meet together in some fancy place in Switzerland where we all drink coffee or tea and figure out how we're going to have some sort of an allegiance and a coalition that will take care of this problem for us. That's just not going to happen. It's just not a realistic outcome right now. And the longer we wait, the more entrenched ISIS becomes, not just in Iraq and Syria, the parts of it that it controls, but in these other countries where it is very clearly trying to establish a beachhead of sorts, or already has and is trying to expand it. Once ISIS becomes the most powerful militia in Libya, what do we really think we're going to do? How are we going to deal with that? We're going to tell some other militia, yeah, go fight them. If you lose, they'll cut off your heads and they'll kill your whole family. But, you know, we're America and we're the good guys, so go and fight them for us. We'll give you weapons. We're going to start giving them weapons. We all know where that can lead to. There's no simple, straightforward answers here, but the administration has other things on its mind. The administration is working on other issues all the time and trying to tell us that this problem is contained, it's under control. What we've seen is actually the opposite of containment. You've seen the spread of this. This would be like if there was an influenza outbreak and you're saying, well, we put the sick person in the tent and we kept him off the side. And well, there are 100 other cases in the last week. But yeah, but you understand, we put somebody, we quarantined the sick patient. But what about all the other people that are getting sick? Oh, no, that's has nothing to do with it. Don't worry about that, because we've done what needed to be. We've done what needed to be done. But that's not true. It's expanded into these other countries. It's already becoming more and more entrenched in countries that have nothing to do with Iraq and Syria. And this ideology, by the way, feeds off of its own
durability and success, right? Meaning that the longer there is something of a caliphate, the longer the Islamic State exists, the easier it is for them to convince people around the world that this is in fact a reality. This could happen. They should start their own version. They should speed this process along. This is a sort of cosmic goal. This is about the future of all humankind. This is about the world. This is about the eternal life to come. Of course, these people who think this are going to lay down their lives in this insane, violent death cult, because they've been told that paradise is awaiting them. And look, there is this Islamic State group that's able to set up, that withstands this the U.S. airstrikes, is now withstanding Russian airstrikes and Assad's airstrikes. Remember the problem we had after the Soviet-Afghan war? The narrative there wasn't that the U.S., with its Stinger missiles, came in and helped out, and the Pakistanis and the ISI were helping, and the Saudis were sending all the money. That wasn't the narrative. Was that these were Mujahideen, these were holy warriors that stood up to the second greatest power, and they would probably argue falsely, but just because it makes them sound cooler, the second greatest power, they would say it's the greatest military power in the world, the Soviet Union, and they defeated them, and then we're next, and we're the softer one. We're the softer power because we have a democracy, right? We have our own people that we have to keep happy, and we're not willing to go and fight to the extent that the Soviets were. And that's what gave it, and from that we had Al-Qaeda, and led us directly to 9/11, and led us to terrorist attacks all over the world, and the metastasizing of that group and its ideology. And so the lessons of the recent past are not that if only we can try to quarantine this one place where we know this extremism, this jihadism, this Islamic fundamentalism has taken root, but that this has to be an across-the-board fight. This is a global struggle. This is everywhere and anywhere that this group exists. And we can try to ignore it and hope that it just sort of goes away, but history also would tell us that that's a losing strategy. So you have very senior intelligence officials here saying that ISIS is not just expanding its presence in currently occupied countries, but also trying to go and break into new countries, and that there are more terrorist safe havens in 2016 than at any time in recent memory in recent history. And this is what the Obama administration, this is the world the Obama administration will bequeath, will hand off to the next commander-in-chief. Bernie Sanders is ready for this. Hillary Clinton is ready for this. I don't know who's ready for this. This is going to be a tough fight. Back after this break. But first, I want to tell you about something else that we've got going on here. Have you ever thought about generating your own supply of off-the-grid electricity? If so, this is going to be the most important message you've ever heard. Here's why. The grid is vulnerable. President Obama is also pushing policies that are meant to generate sky-high prices for electricity going forward. And there's all kinds of problems, all kinds of things that can happen that will mean that you have no power. So there's never been a better time than now to protect your family with a solar generator backup system. In the event of an emergency, it'll give you off-the-grid backup electricity and provide you life-saving electrical power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, it emits no fumes, and produces an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. It's like having an electric power plant running silently in your own home. You can run sump pumps, shortwave radios, computers, and even keep food from spoiling. Whether it's dangerous weather, brownouts, or blackouts, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. So go to BuckSolarBackup.com to learn more. That's Buck, B-U-C-K, SolarBackup.com. Use coupon code BUCK and get a solar generator for half off. Go to BuckSolarBackup.com today. Now back after the break.
Buck Sexton. Dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network. This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Team, the phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. Please do give a call. You can also send us emails, teambuck@theblaze.com. That's teambuck@theblaze.com. We'll be checking through there. Anything you want to talk about, it is a good way for us
to have a chat. Now, I kind of like to do this. You've noticed, probably, those of you listening to the show regularly, I like to talk about immigration over there, then immigration over here. What's going on in Europe with the biggest refugee crisis since the Second World War, and how are we handling immigration in this country, especially given that right now, if you listen to the Republicans, they're all very hawkish, very tough on immigration. I wonder how many of them will keep their current promises. But let's first discuss a little bit about what's going on in Europe right now, and how, remember, these are the most progressive Democrat socialist countries in the world, and these are literally held up as the model by people like Bernie Sanders for what we should aspire to economically, socially, and otherwise. Right. And I actually did like Marco Rubio's line that Bernie Sanders is running for president and he would make a great president of Sweden. I agree. It's not the right president for the United States, to be sure. But even the Swedes, and this is the important point, are realizing that they can't have this little socialist society they want if they allow massive amounts of immigration, because it's not even just an economic issue. It's also a political and cultural issue. How do you replicate the society that is that allows you to have a functioning democrat socialist state? What do you do when you reach a point where there are enough people in a society who don't believe that there should be a separation between the government and religion? What do you do in a society where people can vote out the Constitution as it currently exists? Just remember, these are all just agreements that we live under, right? These are not, there's no, and it's true in this country too, a constitution here or a constitution or a charter of liberties or whatever it is, depending on the European country we're talking about, Declaration of the Rights of Man in France. It's a piece of paper with words on it. If people don't believe it, if they don't imbue it with more than just the most basic textual significance, right? We have to all buy in for these things to work. And in these European states, one of the recognitions they have is, okay, even if, and we'll talk about the effects, the economic effects of immigration on the other side of the break here, it's fascinating, by the way, and I'm digging deeper and deeper into this all the time because I just find it to be such an interesting and misrepresented debate. People are constantly lying to you about the effects of immigration, constantly. And that much I can promise you. I mean, I turn on the TV and I see people talking about immigration and they pretend it's either all good or all bad. Neither of those propositions is true. It's a mixture. And I think that when you add illegal immigration into it, it is much more negative than positive. But anyway, on the European side of things, the Greeks are protesting against migrant camps that are being built on the Greek islands. Some of these are, you know, I spent a summer on a Greek island, actually. Yeah, I know. Good times, Buck. To be 21 again. And wasn't a lot of studying going on there. But nonetheless, stories for another time. And I spent a summer on a Greek. I was supposed to be there for getting credit for a master's degree. I did technically get the credit for it. I didn't finish the degree. I was an undergrad. And it was warm, and there were a lot of beaches, and it was a co-ed program, obviously. So where was I? I completely lost the thread here. Team, 888-900-3393. I'll talk to you about what's going on with the European migrant crisis, and then we'll transition into the truth about immigration here at home in America, some new stats, some new analysis on that. And then we'll just kind of roll with it, see where we go. But I'd love to hear from any of you. 888-900-3393. Back in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show. On the Blaze Radio Network. You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
So, team, back to what's going on with the migrant crisis in Europe. This is one of the biggest, I think this was the biggest story in some ways. I mean, you could say ISIS, but ISIS was really a story from the year before as well. A biggest news story of 2015, and it's changing the way people think about everything, about the future of Europe, of the Western world, of modernity, whatever, however you would define that.
I mean, we in the West have a certain sense of it, but even among Westerners, of course, there are differences in what we consider to be modernity and who's a part of it and who's not. And what we see is a seismic shift in attitudes about, well, do we really have no such thing as a border? Should we just let in as many people as want to come? Are all people going to have the same sorts of reactions to certain societies, even those who come and not only refuse to assimilate, but choose not to allow their children to assimilate either? Is it possible to have a sort of subculture in a country that eventually will take over? I've mentioned to you before, I've just about finished it. I've got a few pages left, so maybe I'll talk to you about it tomorrow. I read this book, Submission, by Michel Houellebecq, and it's interesting. It's a sort of a novel. It's a novel, but it describes how a Muslim Brotherhood victory, a political victory in a place like France, how the other parties, he sort of war games it out, how other political parties would react to this. And it's really the book, and I'm getting ahead of myself because I'll talk to you about it more as soon as I finish the entirety of it, which probably will be tonight. It's a book about the death of democratic socialism in Europe. And it talks the destruction of the family and the inability of these societies to self-replicate because they no longer want people to have children, and the idea that you shouldn't have children and that there's all the, anyway, there's so much in it. But eventually, like I said, I'll talk to you more about that tomorrow. But it's about the death of this Western welfare state, democrat socialist model. It's about the destruction of that and how Islam is going to play a role in that. It's fascinating, right? It's theoretical. It's a novel, but you could see, you know, what would happen in some of these countries. What does Germany, if it keeps letting in a million refugees a year or 800,000 refugees a year, what does Germany and German politics, what does it look like in 10 years? We know that the average German is not having enough children to replace the German population, but immigrants have many children. And if they don't subscribe to the sort of German, the overall German culture, if they want something different than this sort of secular Western socialist state, well, why can't they eventually be a majority and vote for that? Of course they can. There's nothing to stop them from that, really. So that's just sort of backstory of what we're seeing here with Greece and its efforts underway right now to try and prevent there from being just a constant overflow of these refugees from coming in. There are about, this is according to the Wall Street Journal, about 857,000 refugees and other migrants, right? Because everyone's now, if you want to stay, you got to claim to be a refugee. But they entered the EU through Greece, right? Greece is sort of the stepping stone into the rest of the EU. And of course, it's not just about safety. They want the best deal for themselves they can get. So it's not merely a question of whether they're escaping the sort of clutches of death in Syria. They want to go to Germany. They want to go to Sweden. They want to go somewhere where they're going to have the most cushy benefits possible. The Greeks are not going to give these refugees benefits. The Greeks have got their own people that they can't give enough benefits to. I mean, the Greeks are economic basket case. They can't handle this. So there, the Greeks are basically saying, okay, we'll move you on through and push you into the rest of the EU where you can find some place that will board you, essentially, that will take you in. And so Greece has been the gateway in this process for some time. And since, and of course, there are drownings that happen, and there's been some horrific photos of children that have drowned. I mean, this people are risking their lives because they're so desperate to get out of, in many cases, they're in Turkey, but they don't want to stay there. And the Turks don't want to take them in. You know, the Arab countries aren't taking them in. There's a lot of room in some of these Arab countries, a lot of space. They don't want to take them in. You know, Saudis aren't taking them in. So why does it fall on Europe to take them in? Well, the Europeans are starting to ask that question. It's very easy to say, it's very easy to say that Europe should take in all these refugees. And then you start thinking about what it means for Europeans. And they've started to think about this. And that changes the calculation a little bit. 68,000 people have landed in Greece so far this year in 2016. So here we are in the second month, and you've had, less than 100,000 people, 68,000, but you know, you're going to have a pretty hefty number if this continues on for the rest of the year. You're going to have, you know, at least a half a million, maybe a little closer to a million coming in through Greece again. And there'll probably be another half million the year after that, and another, and another, and another. When is it too much? For many of the most sort of open-hearted, you know, those who embrace refugees with open arms, for many of the people that take that approach to these things, you know, you start to ask the question, well, when is it too much? And you have here, and this is from Kellen Howell over at the Washington Times, that the German Catholic Church is calling for a reduction in refugees, and they cannot take in all the world's needy. They said they have Reinhard Marx, Cardinal Reinhard Marx. It's a pretty cool name. Reinhard, I like that. As a church, we say that we need a reduction in the number of refugees. We cannot take in all the world's needy. This is according to The Guardian, a British newspaper. And the church is basically saying, look, we can't handle all this either. You know, there are limitations. There are limits that you can cross here that there's no way that you can deal with this influx, this number of refugees. So we got to start thinking about how we're going to handle all of it. Right. This is just reality now. And when the Catholic Church is saying that we're taking in too many needy, you got a problem. That means the rest of the German state is obviously going to be stretched to its limit. And this is without even taking into account the political and social implications of this. This is just looking at it from a more sort of economic and resource perspective, right? You know, how do we feed people that need to be fed? What do we do here? How do we keep this whole thing going? And the Germans are, I think, increasingly realizing that this is an unsustainable arrangement they have, whereby they're taking in all these people. And we'll just sort of have to see if there's a real political change in Germany that results from all of this. But, you know, Western nations will not die by invasion. They'll die by suicide. And there's a recognition, I think, that that's what's happening in some of these European countries. And as much as they'd like to think that they can take in all these refugees and there won't be any problem, there won't be any consequences, they can't hide from the people in these countries. They can't hide from their own citizens some of what's gone on already. Of course, there was that massive sexual assault, a sort of mass sexual assault in Cologne as well as in other cities. And the media, interestingly enough, reports with glee. This is one of these imbalances that you'll see, and it very much annoys me. The media will report with some degree of glee on how there are these sort of right-wing groups that will pop up, or these anti-immigrant, these groups that come up with sort of, they're going to prevent sexual violence against their native women by just walking or marching around and such. And the media loves to report on that. And that somehow is supposed to be indicative of anybody who has any questions about whether mass immigration from Muslim war zones is a good idea for the people in these countries. Is it a nice idea? You know, would it be great if we lived in a world where that was an easy decision? Sure. But is it a good idea for the citizens of those countries? Well, that's the question that, you know, we would have to ask. But if you ask that question, they make it seem like you're all dressed in black and carrying a nightstick and are part of these ultra right wing parties. So a few, a few knuckleheads walking around saying that they're going to defend their native women against, that's front page news for a lot of European papers. And that's indicative of this sort of violent anti-immigrant attitude. But 1,000 immigrants running around grabbing women, sexually assaulting them, raping them, that's just like, we shouldn't even report on that because it'll create stigma. And this is when people just stop trusting the media, when the media is playing these sorts of games. The media does it in Europe, and the media does the exact same thing here, of course, right? When we're talking about whether it's about police shootings or any number of issues. When is it indicative of the whole, and when is it just something that's a one-off? You know, no broader lesson, no broader theme to take away from this. And in the case of, you know, European migration issues vis-a-vis the Muslim world, you can see that they always want to downplay the downside, quite honestly, of what it means to take in many of these are men mostly, which has also been pointed out. These are young men coming from the Muslim world who are entering these new societies. Many of them have been subject to horrific trauma, whether physical or psychological or both. And they don't speak the language. They have no connection to these cultures. And yeah, it is a problem for them to see women walking around dressed as Western women do, because not this is one of the big lies is that, oh, they have their way and we have our way. It's like this is like a fashion statement. No, they think that women that don't wear a fully covered head and covered body are essentially prostitutes. That they are morally degraded. That they're women who are easy and they're putting themselves on display. This is what men in some of these countries and some of these societies. This is what they're taught. This is what they learn. And so, yeah, that's going to result in problems in some of these countries. It's going to result in pretty terrible problems. And we've seen some of that happening already. And the media wants to tell us, oh, well, there's nothing really that ties these things together. These are just random incidents. Meanwhile, as I say to you, anytime there's any violence, anytime a bunch of thugs get together and say they're going to go beat up an immigrant, well, that's like a front page news story around the world, because that's indicative of everybody who has any questions about this. See, they're always playing games. They're not just trying to report. They're trying to create a narrative. And the narrative right now in Europe is getting harder and harder for the left, the Democrat socialist left, to control. Like in this book that I've read, eventually it just collapses under its own weight because the Islamic groups are dedicated, better organized, and believe in having a lot of kids. And in a society where you have one man, one vote, or one woman, one vote, having a lot of kids matters. So these are the implications of all this that people don't want to talk about or don't want to discuss, but we'll discuss it. I also want to talk about economics and immigration here at home. We'll do that on the other side of the break. 888-900-3393. Back in a few.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
Well, here's a story that Breitbart.com is covering. It doesn't really fall in line with the pro-refugee narrative that media tends to want to push, but here we have it. Islamic State commander found living as refugee in rural German village. This is from Sarkis Zeronian of Breitbart.com. In the latest of a series of raids, German police have searched two homes in a rural village after a television channel interviewed a suspected Islamic State commander living there as a refugee. Sankt Johann is a small village in the southwest German state, Rhineland-Palatinate. It has 800 residents. It's in the shadow of a 14th century Gothic church. And yet, Spiegel TV reported over the weekend that there were police raids there because there's a guy who's living there who says that he was an Islamic State leader. This is amazing. The two houses in the village are used for Syrian refugees. There's a suspected commander of ISIS was there after tip-off from other Syrian activists. So he's a notorious, they identified him as a man named Bassam, a notorious commander who was responsible for the death of dozens of people. So, you know, these are some of the people who are coming. His original ambition, this piece says, was to be a suicide bomber, but his brother used his position as a Sharia judge to secure him his officer's role, and he was captured at a checkpoint north of Aleppo by Free Syrian Army soldiers, and then he was released, and now he's in Germany. So this is an Islamic State commander who's killed dozens of people, got captured on the battlefield, somehow managed to get out, now posed as a refugee, and is living among other Syrian refugees in this idyllic, cute little German town in the shadow of a Gothic cathedral. This is the kind of stuff. Now, this is one that we know about, right? This is one that we're aware of, but there are others. There are clearly going to be others. How many are too many? How many Islamic State commanders are too much risk for us to sort of just continue? And keep in mind, this is what's happening in Europe because they're coming from Turkey and elsewhere also. They're coming from Libya, too, and finding their way to Greece. Some small European states are just walling themselves off, literally walling themselves off. Yeah, that's right. Walls can work. Fences can work.
They're building fences. They're building walls. They're saying we've had enough of this. So, yeah, this is going on over there. I told you that we would talk about immigration in this country, and I want to do that because this is, I think it's one of the most important issues. And a lot of the candidates say that, one of the most important issues facing this country. But I don't believe many of them. I think a lot of them are saying what they have to say now to placate the base. I'm talking about Republicans now. And the moment that any one of them get into office and they're working with Congress, then all of a sudden the donor power on this issue, because it is a huge benefit. Illegal immigration and legal immigration is a huge benefit to the employer class, but it harms the employee class. So that's a distinction we're going to talk about in the next hour. Hour three of the Buck Sexton Show is coming up. Stay with me.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Thank you for joining. Great to have you with me. 888-900-3393. Let's talk a little bit about illegal immigration, shall we? Because candidates all say it's a big issue for them, right? We hear about this on the campaign trail. Candidates all say that this is something that they have to pay close attention to. And the Wall Street Journal, which, let's all just be very clear from the get-go, the Wall Street Journal is a pro-increased immigration, pro-H-1B visa, generally speaking, is writing in favor of immigration in such a way that will benefit the employer class, the donor class, those who have others do labor for them, right? The owners as opposed to the laborers, so to speak. The Wall Street Journal tends to favor that point of view, with its editorial pages, but also just in its general coverage. But they have this piece on the thorny economics of illegal immigration, and it uses Arizona as a case study. Now, Arizona, when it got some stricter laws on illegal immigration in recent years, saw something of a drop in illegals, many of whom went to neighboring states where there weren't such strict rules in place, specifically rules about employment, right? So they started to use E-Verify, and there were other things that they put in place that were meant to make it harder, make it less hospitable for illegal immigrants to stay in the state and to work. And Arizona's economy, as the Wall Street Journal describes, it took a bit of a hit, but it took a hit that also benefited laborers, and it meant that some of the farmers, for example, some of the landowners who had been using illegal labor in the fields, had to make some investments. But they invested in mechanization that does the work of these laborers, and now they're like, you know what? That's okay. I don't have to worry about a crew of workers showing up. I don't have to deal with that. I don't have to worry about the headache about possibly having the law in force where I'm not supposed to be employing these people. And this one individual says that he, for the harvest of his jalapeno peppers, which is what he's harvesting for his farm, he was trying to cut the number of laborers he needed by 90% and hire more well-paid U.S.-based machinists instead. So you don't hire as many illegal laborers in this case study, in this context. What you do is you hire or you invest in mechanization and machinery, and then you pay somebody to run the machine and do upkeep on the machine, but it's one person or a few people as opposed to dozens of people. And over the long run, this is actually better for the farm. So while there are some of these migrant farmer families that or migrant farm labor families that have moved, the economy has adjusted, and it also means that there are people who are low-skilled, low-skilled labor has seen a rise in wages in Arizona. People are getting paid more
because you can't just go down to, as they talk about here, you can't go down to sort of a local hardware store and hire a crew of illegal immigrants to do whatever job you want them to do. That's become more difficult in Arizona. And as a result of that, people who do construction, and this is for native born, meaning including Hispanics. This is not broken down by racial lines. This is by illegal immigrants versus people legally in the country, including Hispanic laborers, white laborers, black laborers, everybody. But for anybody in a low-skilled profession, low-skilled job, the wages in the state of Arizona went up a little bit. Now, this is very straightforward because this is a simple supply and demand issue. And this is what the sort of the I've seen this with people from the Cato Institute and those. They always play this game of, well, no, it's just the native born workers will just move on to higher skilled professions. That's not how it works. And it's not that easy. It's not that simple. And they, you know, there's a dishonesty here when one side is pretending that there's no trade-off, that there's no trade-off inherent in this process, that what ends up happening is you just have nothing but economic benefit from illegal immigration. Whenever they start to go down that path, and I've actually had this debate with some of the sort of de facto open borders crowd, including some libertarians who take that perspective, what I always say is, okay, so is there ever, do you ever reach the number where it's too much? Is there ever a point at which, is there any drawback to immigration whatsoever? They'll say, oh, well, you know, it's in the short term, maybe there'll be some costs to your local community. Really, just in the short term. That's it, huh? Is there, and then you get into this sort of war over statistics because they'll say, well, you know, you're not actually, that the native-born population is not actually less likely to use welfare than the illegal immigrant population or the immigrant population in general, by the way. And you get into this back and forth over whose statistics are correct. But the bottom line is that supply and demand still matters. It still functions. It's still a thing, whether people who are advocates for mass immigration or not admit it. It's still there. And it's in this case in Arizona, we've seen this now playing out. And this piece goes through various researchers who are all trying to make their case. But large scale immigration undermining wages of low skilled workers seems to be kind of a slam dunk case at this point. Now, that's not to say that there aren't other aspects of this, too. Right. There can be overall there can be a bit of a drop in the economy because there might be less productivity in the short term because some of these farms and some of these other places where illegal immigrants tend to congregate for work might not be quite as productive and their costs might go up a little bit. But then there's an offset to that, which is that the people who are native born and people who are in the country legally are more in demand. Their services are more in demand. And so, again, this brings us back to how this is really about a redistribution of wealth. It's not about just wealth creation. It's not the more immigrants you have, the richer everybody is. That's not true. There are people who are very clearly harmed by this, whose economic prospects are harmed by this. And now this is just straight up on the economic side of things, by the way. We're not even talking about what's fair. We're not even talking about impact on crime. We're not talking about jumping to the front of the immigration line, the politics, the political implications of having one, in particular, one class of immigrants from Mexico, who are part of a contiguous country that has a history of controlling states that are currently part of the U.S. And there's a sort of irredentist streak that still exists, as well as a lack of irredentism, meaning they still believe that this land belongs to Mexico. That still exists in some quarters. But even more importantly, there's still ties to the sort of homeland, the previous country. And there's no real impetus to change that. You don't feel the desire to assimilate if you're living among all Spanish speakers and you can hop in a car and be back in the home country in 2 hours, right? That doesn't make you feel like, well, I necessarily really have to change my cultural outlook or adopt the ways of my new country, whether you're coming here legally or illegally. So that also is all very different. The political implications of this don't get much talk, don't get much play, but they're very real. And anyway, but back to the economic side of it, they see that undocumented workers between 2007 and 2012 in Arizona dropped, at least officially, by 40%. A lot of them, this is according to the Pew Research Center, and a lot of them just moved to neighboring states. And what they end up finding out is that this means that there was a decrease in Arizona's gross domestic product between 2008 and 2015. And there was a decrease in employment as well, but there were higher wages for people that got those jobs. And this is where things get really contentious. They also start to look at the costs of illegal immigrants on the dollars and cents costs of illegal immigrants on the broader society on the rest of the state. So Arizona's population of illegal immigrants, according to this Wall Street Journal piece, grew nearly fivefold between 1990 and 2005 to about 450,000. And then starting around 2004, the state approved of a series of measures, either by ballot initiative or legislation, aimed at discouraging illegal immigration. And undocumented immigrants in Arizona, about 85% of whom came from Mexico, are barred from receiving government benefits, including non-emergency hospital care. They can't receive punitive damages in lawsuits, in civil lawsuits. They can't get driver's licenses and aren't eligible for in-state tuition. So Arizona is pretty tough on all this stuff. And yet the economy in Arizona has been okay. And, you could argue that the worker shortage that was created as a result of this meant that there was wages rose. Here's the other side of this. Wages rose by 15% for Arizona farm workers and 10% for construction workers. So, yeah, you're going to, the owners of these farms and the people that are paying for construction work, they have to pay a little more, but the laborers get more. And the owners are benefiting from using illegal labor, and this is where the real costs kick in. That illegal labor, by the way, is availing itself. Those individuals are using, for one thing, that when they have a kid, once they have a child here, that now, as we know, anchor baby, then it's everything is open to them, right? Because a child gets all federal benefits as a citizen, and we're not going to break up that family, so they know they can stay, and they can, in fact, be sponsored, and the rest of the family can be sponsored by that one child born here in this country. But on top of that, the big cost, and I've talked to you a little bit about this before, comes in the schools and how the schools are having to spend a tremendous amount of resources to try to bring these immigrant children, illegal immigrant children, up to speed, or children who are born here to illegal immigrant parents, a tremendous amount of effort to bring them up to speed, English language instruction for them, or instruction in Spanish so they can keep up with the rest of the class. And in these communities, this means that there's also just an influx of students in the public schools that are, taking resources, that are taking in more resources than they give out. And by the way, than they pay in taxes. And by the way, another thing, and I'm sorry I'm jumping around here, but when you hear people like John Kasich say that illegal immigrants are going to pay back taxes, that's a lie. Because most of them are not making enough money, even if they were to accurately tell us what their income is, which they won't. Most of them don't make enough money. They get money back from the government. They'd probably get the earned income tax credit. I mean, they'd get tax credits. They get a check from Uncle Sam. They're not sending a check to Uncle Sam, even if for this whole back taxes thing for millions of illegals. That's crap. It's a lie. But it's a lie that's repeated time and time again. But you have this piece in Fox News, on foxnews.com. It says that illegal immigrants benefited from up to $750 million in Obamacare subsidies. We were told this was never going to happen, but turns out that it is happening. That credits for Obamacare went to more than 500,000 people, and in many cases they are illegal immigrants or those whose legal status was unclear due to insufficient records. So we can't say definitively that illegal immigrants got $750 million in Obamacare subsidies, but we can say that, a lot of them did. A lot of Obamacare subsidies are going to people who are not even in the country legally. And by the way, you think a Democrat administration is going to turn that spigot, is going to open that spigot up or close it off? It's going to be even more, right? Because really the thing that Obamacare loves to do the most is to give people free health care if possible, and to make people who actually are earning a living, particularly those who are in what is termed the middle class by Democrats. We're always talking about the middle class. They have to pay more. So they subsidize the middle and upper middle class, so to speak, subsidizes the lower middle class and low income families. And that's how this whole thing is supposed to work. So, you know, if you're working hard and you're paying your bills, your health care gets a little worse and a little more expensive. And those without health care get health care and don't pay anything. That's really the way the system functions. And illegal immigrants are going to increasingly play a role in all of this. Because as I said to you, under current law, if you have an anger baby, you're here. You're not going anywhere. And there are all sorts of ways that they get access to these benefits. And, well, you know, we're not deporting people. You think they're really going to enforce Obamacare fraud against individuals? I don't think so. So these are the costs of this. And it's very clear, and the numbers don't lie, but people still like to cling to this fiction that they do the jobs Americans won't do, and that it's a net benefit to the economy, and that it's only a benefit to the economy, and there's no drawback, there's no downside. It's just not true. 888-900-3393. We'll go to a break here, back right after.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network. Sexton.
I got to go back to this, and I've got some other topics I want to talk to you about, so we're not going to drift backwards into doing more and more political analysis here. But this idea that Bill Clinton is like the secret weapon of the Clinton campaign is pretty hilarious to me. You know, he's sort of just showing up, hey, everybody, you know, I'm here, and I'm just going to, like, get all your votes and get all your ladies. I'm just ready for it, so here we go. Come on now. And I don't know why, you know, why that still is out there, that this guy is supposed to be sort of be electrifying a room or a crowd. You know, he was president 15 or 16 years ago. It's been a while. And I don't know why people seem to think that this is going to be the magic, you know, the magic of the 90s will be unleashed again. They might as well put, you know, Jerry Seinfeld and Alanis Morissette on stage and be like, guys, do your thing. It just doesn't work that way. Right. Although, you know, Seinfeld does his comedians drinking coffee in cars thing, which is entertaining. But, you know, it's never going to be the same. You know, Seinfeld was a thing. It was then. There's no more Seinfeld show unless you watch the reruns. And I don't know how Alanis Morissette was ever a thing in terms of the music, but it was. She was. And that's what we got going on here. They're trying to trot out Bill, and Bill's supposed to be, you know, this magician just comes out like, hey, look at my hand over here. And all of a sudden, poof, presto, there we go. Now you love Hillary. And hey, lady in the back, what's your phone number? I mean, this is what we're expecting all over the place. And it's not working out that way. And in fact, Bill says some pretty weird stuff, including when he was in New Hampshire, what was this, yesterday, he was trying to introduce his wife before a bunch of supporters. And this is what he had to say. Play it.
The hotter this election gets, the more I wish I were just a former president and just for a few months, not the spouse of the next one. Because, you know, I have to be careful what I say. Tonight, my job is to introduce Hillary. Sometimes when I'm on a stage like this, I wish we weren't married. Then I could say what I really think.
Well, I just really wish I wasn't married, because I could just really let it rip and, you know.
First of all, why can't he just say whatever he wants? As a, you know, he's Bill Clinton, right? He's a politician. It's not like anyone's expecting him to be keeping to some sort of schedule of charity events and keeping his mind or keeping his mouth shut if Hillary were in fact to be the president, right? So no one has that expectation of him, and this is a guy who's out there stumping on the stump for her. And yet he's saying, you know, yeah, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't be married. I mean, you know, that'd be like, I mean, that would be terrible in some ways, but in other ways it'd be great because, you know, me and all the ladies could get together and I wouldn't have to, like, be worried about Hillary getting mad. Although Hillary doesn't get mad. It's, you know, you'll notice how the media doesn't cover the sham marriage aspect of the Clintons at all. There's no interest. I know we're supposed to just assume that that's fine, but why is that fine? This is just, it's okay that he's got mistresses and, you know, they're married just because they pretend to be married. Well, why is that supposed to be normal? Remember, you know, you look at these other families, you look at, you know, Romney's background, and people were being, I remember the media was being nasty about Romney's wife, who has MS, because she liked to ride horses, and that was so elitist, right? But Bill and Hillary, who are also super elitists, worth over $100 million, they can just sort of be in this fake marriage, and no one asks any questions, and that's supposed to be fine. You know, and that's, I mean, I guess people say, oh, well, you shouldn't be questioning somebody else's marriage. Okay, well, now I guess that, you know, if family life is off the table, isn't that an interesting new twist in politics? But I digress. All right, I want to talk to you about something that I see the administration doing that I think is going to get a lot bigger, and I'm not sure people are paying enough attention to it. We'll be talking about it right after this break. Stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. Let's take Marla in San Diego. Marla, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Hey, Buck. How you doing?
Good. How are you, Marla?
Pretty good. When you're talking about the Obamacare and how much immigrants, legal or not legal immigrants, are picking up Obamacare subsidies, my daughter works in a junior college financial aid office, and it's starting to get pretty rough for her because she works a full-time job so that she has insurance to cover her and her son, and then goes to school at night and works a few hours in the financial aid office, in the counseling office, to be able to help subsidize her cost of college. You would not believe the amount of students that come in saying, I want the free stuff like the immigrants are getting. They're getting the Obamacare for free, not having to pay their own way, and they're getting to go to school for free and getting subsidies for their books and tuition and extra cash from Pell Grants to be able to pay for their living expenses. So you've got a bunch of the millennials that are starting to pick up on the fact that it's not fair and it's skewed against them.
Marla, why would it's one thing for immigrants to avail themselves of these services and benefits, whether legally or not, but you're telling me that there are services that they get that native-born Americans can in terms of college? I mean, that was the one part where I had a question there.
Yes, they're getting free college where the natural born, living here in San Diego County, going all the way through school from kindergarten through high school with my daughter, they can't get any subsidies, and it's harder to get any kind of scholarship or grant. And immigrant people are getting it for free and plus living expenses.
So you're saying that there are grants that the federal government is giving or scholarships that are out there for immigrants that are not there for native-born Americans?
Oh, that part is true, but also the fact that they're not paying tuition at all. They're told, you come in and we'll get you in here for college for free. And here you've got kids that are working one and two part-time jobs, full-time jobs, and they're not getting their college.
Oh, wait, so you're saying the school, okay, this is it. So the schools are making this decision in some cases. The schools are saying, oh, you're an immigrant, you don't have to pay, but if you're native-born American and you're working a couple of jobs and trying to put your way through, you do have to pay. That's an important distinction. This is what I was trying to get at. So the schools themselves are making these decisions.
The UC system, so whether it's University of California or whether it is legislated, I'm not sure. But they're getting their stuff for free, and our kids are having to pay, or the parents are having to pay. And a lot of these kids, I'm saying kids, but they're over 26. So they're no longer on their parents' insurance. A lot of them are really, they're coming in right now saying, look, I can't afford to pay for health insurance, and I also can't afford to pay the fines for Obamacare. What can you do for me?
This is what's happening. I mean, these sorts of things are happening across the country. I'd be very curious to know how exactly it works that immigrants are getting, particularly illegal immigrants, are getting free tuition, whether that's the school's decision or how that works legally. I don't know. I have to look into that more. But Marla from San Diego, thank you very much for calling in. Let's take Angie in Texas. Angie, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hi, Buck. I have an example of illegals getting subsidies, also non-illegals, just based on what language they speak. I have two sons that go to a public school near Houston. It's in Deer Park. When they started to enter the school, my eldest was going into kindergarten. Now I was paying $800 a month for daycare for them both to go. Now, when the one went into kindergarten, the school district had a pre-K program. I went to apply for it. They said, you make too much money. And I did it simply because I didn't want to have to drive two different places. I was single. It was costing me a fortune anyway, a car note. And I go, I will pay you the same thing that I am paying the daycare, just so I don't have to drive the other place, just so they'll be in the same place. And they go, well, do you speak Spanish? I'm like, no. They go, well, then you can't. I go, let me get this right. I make too much money for them to go. But if I made $1 million and my kids spoke Spanish in our household, and you don't even have to be a citizen, they could go here. They go, that's right. So if you're illegal and you didn't speak the native language, you could go there for free, which I paid $400 to another place to go. If you made $1 million, legal, spoke Spanish, you got to go for free as well. I was trying to pay. I'm just telling you, it did.
I know, but how does that? So, what's their justification for how why Spanish language would make a difference there? Is it because I don't understand how they could do that?
It's a foreign language, and what it is well, it's a pre-K program. We're trying to help the children assimilate and get a better standing, which I understand. I get it, but here I am trying to pay money to them, and they won't accept it. They will take anybody for free that doesn't speak the native language for a pre-K program into the school district.
So this okay, and this is a public school. How does this work? Is it getting public funds, or is it a private institution? I'm trying to follow this. I don't have kids, so I don't understand daycare very well.
Okay, so daycare, private institution. You know, a private individual, you could say, just outside the public school system. So I'm paying for them to go to daycare. It's $400
okay.
a week. Now, they're going to public school. One of them was, okay, so into the kindergarten program. That's an established grade now. The public school has a pre-K program that I think, now I can't swear to this, is funded by the Texas State Education. It's a grant. Somehow that works out. And their deal is that, okay, for people who can't afford for their children to go to pre-K to get that leg up, you know, to get that introduction into kindergarten or being able to, you know, to socialize and read, we will have a pre-K program. We will fund it to help these children who don't speak English, who don't go to daycare, help assimilate by the time they get into kindergarten. So that is all funded to a public school. I am coming over and saying, instead of me going and paying this private institution just for the sake of me not having to drive 20 extra miles one way, and I will actually pay you. I'm not even wanting it for free. I will pay you, school district, $400 a month to get that program. No, you can't do it because, A, you make too much money. We can't accept your money, and you can't come here free because you make too much money. But if you spoke another language, well, then it doesn't matter what your money is.
Right. Okay. Now I get it. So it's a grant program, and they're making these distinctions between native language speakers and or native English speakers rather, and also people make a certain amount of money. Angie, this kind of stuff it doesn't get really reported on very much, and I hear people say that, you know, immigrants are treated better in some contexts than native-born Americans. And I hear stories like this, and I say, well, yeah, that sounds like what is going on. Angie from Texas, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
I mean, I know for a fact that at private institutions across the country, private universities, private colleges, if you are a Latino immigrant, I mean, this is it's a huge leg up in the admissions process. And that's I know that for a fact. So I know that there are these distinctions that are being drawn and they exist. And by the way, if you write your college essay about how your parents came here illegally across the border and now, you know, you graduated high school, you're the first in your family, like it doesn't really matter what your SATs are. Harvard's not going to be able to take you fast enough. I mean, if you can meet the most basic requirements to be a student at a top university or top college, they'll take you based upon that story alone. So I do know that there are these distinctions being drawn and that there's a favorability or there's favoritism, I should say, that's shown towards immigrants and immigrant children. But, you know, once you start talking to me about trying to use what's going on in public schools and grant programs and telling me that there are people that are getting free tuition, and if it's a school that's even maybe not a public school, but a school that has getting a lot of federal funds, and it's making the decision to educate immigrant children at the expense of native-born children. I mean, this stuff is just crazy. But it's really hard to get a straight story on. It's really hard to get the truth because a lot of people don't want it to get out there that these sorts of things are happening. And, you know, it's amazing. You're often talking here when you're talking about these immigrant issues. You're oftentimes in a position where you just feel like I can't even get the numbers. You know, I can't even get the basics of what's going on here because the state has a vested interest in keeping this all kind of murky and just repeating, you know, diversity is our strength. Immigration is a net benefit. And anybody who has any questions about that is a xenophobic racist. OK, I guess that's supposed to be the end of the discussion. But I want to talk to you about some school stuff that's happening. That's, I think, a very big policy that the Obama administration is slowly rolling out. And you can expect it to get much bigger. We'll talk about that right after this break.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on The Blaze Radio Network.
So, team, I know I said I would talk to you about this new initiative the Obama administration is undergoing to punish colleges that lie about the prospects of jobs for those who go there. This is really just a backdoor way of a lot of relieving a lot of students of their student debt. So this is a fascinating thing. I don't have the time, though, today, unfortunately. I went a little long. I don't have the time to get into the details. So you're going to have to do me a favor. You're going to have to tune in tomorrow and we can discuss this as well as the results of the first in the nation New Hampshire primary, which I'm sure will be interesting, particularly that number 2, 3 and 4 spots on the GOP side. And for at least the next 24 hours, America, we're going to feel the burn. Bernie Sanders making it happen, getting a big win, racking up a win up in New Hampshire. But first, we have Lisa in California who's going to weigh in. Lisa, thanks for calling in. Appreciate it.
Hello, Buck. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Go Team Buck. Okay, I was going to tell you about the Section 8 housing up here in Monterey County. They are building a ton of it, but they are also giving notice to people who are living in it. The guy who does my lawn, his daughter lives in Section 8 housing and her son, and they've been given notice to remove themselves within 90 days because they are bringing in refugees and people who have crossed the border, and we need our Section 8 housing for them.
Wait, so you're telling me that this is a U.S. citizen who's being told he has to get out of Section 8 housing to make room for...
To make room what? For illegals and refugees.
Did they really tell him that, though, or is he just assuming
that? Yeah, no, it's the notice on the door. I've seen it myself because my gardener, Tony, is coming over to my house saying, oh, my God, what can we do about this? And I'm trying to figure out what we can do about it, and so far nothing. Because it's a sanctuary state, and they want more people here illegally than they want legal people.
That's astonishing. I mean, I know that California also gave out 605,000 driver's licenses last year to illegal aliens in California.
600,000 legal aliens now, courtesy of the state of California, have driver's licenses.
If we yes, they do. And now if we pass a bill saying that you have to have a driver's license to vote, what does that do to our voting credentials? We have no way of doing anything about this influx. California has been taken over by La Raza. Texas will be next. And they're just going to push their way through state by state.
Wow. All right. Lisa, thanks for calling in. Although bleak stuff from the Golden State today. Thank you for calling in. Yeah, I see this this tendency among conservatives, conservative authors and some of the sort of pundit class. They like to refer to white nativism, and they really enjoy denigrating in writing and in speech anybody who has concerns about this immigration issue. And you know, the fact that there can be a thing called illegal immigration, meaning the violation of U.S. federal law, and that anybody who even questions that this is on a massive scale a problem, right, that the massive violation and continuous violation of U.S. federal immigration law is problematic, if you question that, you're told that there's something wrong with you. This is how upside down this discussion is. And the more that you start to push and demand answers on these issues, wait a second, why is it in-state tuition for illegals? That's just redistributing wealth from citizens to non-citizens. I mean, are we running a giant soup kitchen? And this brings me back to what the Catholic Church says in Germany, which is, look, we're trying, but the soup kitchens are full, right? There's only so much we can do. There's only so much you can ask us to do here. You need to slow this down. Look, at some point it becomes an economic issue, a resource issue, a political issue, a social issue. These are essential things for us to have a very open and honest discussion about, because it has to do with the future of this country and the country that your children and your grandchildren are going to inherit. But the media just wants to shut it down. You know, diversity is our strength. Immigration is always good. The more the merrier. And anybody who has any problem with it should just be shunned and ostracized. And that's just wrong. Now, if you're in favor of enforcing federal law, you're a bad guy. That's the way it is. All right. Please download today's show. Go to theblaze.com/BuckSexton. You can also go to soundcloud.com, iTunes, or Stitcher. And I will join you tomorrow here in the Freedom Hut. As always, shields high.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.